Hello, and welcome back to the Nth Venture Podcast, a podcast for, by, and about founders and the hard knocks they take. We're pulling them right out of the middle of the grind to talk triumphs, tragedies, and most importantly, lessons learned of building something great. Hello, everyone. This week, I have the wonderful pleasure of sitting down with Mr. Mehran Pober of Acquisitions.com. Real international citizen who has been wheeling and dealing since, I believe, birth, probably, is my estimation. A really interesting character that I think drives home the importance for a lot of new entrepreneurs on diversification and thinking about risk halfway intelligently, even though you're driving really hard and have extreme focus, how to do that while not putting all of your eggs in one basket. I think this is a little bit of a masterclass on that. Now, being able to take that and create basically the organizational manifestation of that through acquisitions.com, I think is really interesting and a very similar idea to what we're doing at Adventure. So, no further ado, acquisitions.com, Mr. Mehran Pober. Pleasure to have you, buddy. You know, this is one of the few, you know, we've got a real serious serial entrepreneur. I've done a couple that had, you know, several entrepreneurial experience, but you've done this thing like a lot. So I'm really excited to hop in here. And I realize that the story is maybe a little bit longer. So I'll have to, you know, pick and choose your favorites maybe. But I know that you are, you know, currently founder running acquisitions.com, but I'm sure there's a lot of stories in there. Maybe talk about some of the first ones and doing all that scaling up is very exciting. So I'm happy to dig in wherever you like. Maybe take us to the first kind of forays into the crazy world of entrepreneurship.
Yeah, 100%. So I'm a pretty simple guy, I think. My name is Mehran Pober. I'm originally from Israel. I'm currently kind of like a bit of a global citizen. Have residency in a few countries, but I'm at the moment in Cyprus, which is a small, nice island in Europe. I started as an entrepreneur at the age of 16, 17, selling flowers in the street with a friend that made me good money. And then at the age of 18, I went to the military. Probably got my first entrepreneurial lesson there, which is the fact that I realized that I didn't really have a business. I had a job inside of a business. And there was basically no business if I wasn't in that business. After that, finished the military. I was bartending for a while and probably for around 8 months or so. And during that period, call it, I started my first business or businesses. So I started selling some stuff on eBay, pretty much buying stuff on the local market, selling it on eBay. And then I also started flipping domains. I would say that that's what started to make me nice amount of money back then.
Yeah, I didn't know you're in the domain game. What year must that have been?
2011, 12, something like that.
That's really interesting. Because I'm always really curious about that. I mean, the turnover that I've seen, I don't know if it was different back then, but you know, when I started looking at it, they're like, yeah, you'll maybe be able to sell like 2% of your portfolio. Was it different back then? Or was that just kind of like the name of the game?
So it's definitely a small percentage. But what I've done is also, I had at some point hundreds of websites, anywhere between 1 to 5 pages of content in each of those. And that was in times where you could rank a website on Google like really fast. Like I had people from the Philippines writing content, and within literally a few articles that barely said anything in English, you were on page one. You could put Google AdSense on things. You could put affiliate offers on things. So I was able to make cash flow from those websites. And whenever I had an offer on the domain, which many times just came because of the domain and not necessarily because of the website and the income from the website, that allowed me to also flip things. Yeah, so that's what started things. Then I'd say my major breakthrough was an app company that I bought almost accidentally. Friend of a friend told me about this company that he had that was barely making money. I paid for it over time, around $50,000. And it was an app company that was basically developing different kind of apps for the App Store, which I think still people do that, but basically looked at apps that ranked high in different parts in the App Stores and tried to see if they can replicate them really fast. It was all right, but then call it luck, call it some skills that I built and people that I hired. We turned it around. One of the app became top 100 app in the App Store. It used to do tips for iPhone, literally just kind of like productive ways of using your iPhone, how to screenshot, how to, I don't know, create more storage. So I think that was my first major breakthrough. That also opened my eyes to the world of acquisitions. It's also opened, I think, my eyes to the world of technology in general. We were really early to the game of Facebook ads, for example. We were one of the first one, I think, to run Facebook ads, install ads to directly to an app, which I think was really helpful because we had a free version of the app with an ads and then a paid version without it. Anyway, I'm ranting here, but that's kind of like...
No, this is great. Yeah, so back in the day, what was... I don't know if you remember like a typical call it cost per acquisition, but what did that look like on Facebook ads coming to like your freemium?
Yeah, man, nothing. Like I remember, I would tell you after that, I remember numbers from 2 or 3 years later where I was able to acquire minority in a media business that was similar to kind of like what BuzzFeed is doing. And I remember we had clicks, again, it depends, but we had clicks for 0.09, like... Nines, like crazy
number. Clicks.
Yeah. And, yeah, but again, it depends. Like on that kind of like BuzzFeed type website, it was very viral. So that was obviously helpful. But even before that, definitely below 50 cents per click. And then we knew we would make money from ads. And then a lot of people upgraded or just bought the paid one right away. And forget about the cost to acquire a user. It's also the boost that you received in the App Store from seeing outside traffic. And nowadays, I don't know how they treat that. They probably recognize that traffic, but it also gave you like an organic boost. That was the most important for us in the end of the day.
A stimulus, if you will.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about, it sounds like you're more or less running solo there for a few years at the beginning, bringing on those offshore folks. Tell me a little bit about the staffing as that rolled out. Like when did you find yourself with a kind of recurring team, and talk a little bit about some of the nightmares of being a manager. When did that evolve for you?
Yeah, 100%. So when I had the app company, I already had a few employees there, very small team, but I definitely then used my experience of hiring remote people to create, for example, a lot of the content. So I think back then, including my websites, I had 100 plus employees. A lot of them, mostly probably 80% plus, are like Philippines, India. Looking back, it was a bit of a nightmare, but the workforce was so cheap. Like compared to right now, again, it was many, many years ago, but I remember, I think we hired people for like 200, 300 bucks a month full time. Nowadays, you need to hire what? You probably need to pay them at least 1,000, 2,000 bucks a month. And again, I didn't hire full time remote people for a while, but like a lot of them are not cheap anymore. I think we really had an arbitrage opportunity there that just isn't that available right now. Like right now you have super talented people around the globe, and it just almost became the norm to work with people from abroad. I think the standard for remote employees is also increased. So I had tons of problems. Like, you know, I'm sure like any entrepreneur out there, I don't know, people stealing, people not showing it for work, people argue internally.
I think it's interesting that SEO is probably one of the biggest forces for globalization that's out there. You know, I mean, yeah. You know, taking that arbitrage out. Okay, so that's a pretty sizable, you know, workforce that you're working with at a fairly young age. And then, so you kind of started talking about the transition into more full-time workers. What was some of that like? You know, did you ever go full-time in an office, or is it more or less just been all these remote folks the whole time you're coming up?
Yeah, so we had an office. So like I said, with the Up company, there was an office space. Like we paid the lease for that. I, to be honest, mostly like always had my home as the home base. And if I had an office, I would go to the office. So I would go to the office, let's say a few days a week or a few hours a day every now and then. But I was never a person to go to the office from 9 to 5. I always traveled, moved around. Like when COVID happened, I remember friends of mine are like, oh, okay, now everyone's going to live like you, basically. Now people understand what it's like to live like you in the last... Like I've been living like that for pretty much the last 15 years almost. So I don't know anything else. I think an office space is super important, especially in the beginning stages of business. But eventually, when you have processes and systems, yeah, it's more about keeping people accountable with KPIs and whatnot. I believe that most people go to the office every day. I'm talking about like big companies and whatnot. They're only productive, what, 3 hours a day at most?
Yeah, the studies on that are horrific. I mean, you're lucky if you get 2 hours of work out of folks on a consistent basis.
So, I don't know, call it intuition or just laziness. I just always like to work from home. And I traveled a lot, so that helped as well. It's almost like I had no option to go to the office. And it's kind of like right now when I talk to people who want to buy businesses and they ask me, how can I make sure that I'm not going to buy myself another job? I tell them, yeah, make sure it's not in a driving distance from you. Then, you know, you'll be forced. Like when you're not around, I mean, you'll find a way to make it work if you have to. So at some point, like I remember at some point I had different businesses in different countries and I can only be in one country at a time. So it's kind of like, okay, and don't get me wrong, it's not easy. And obviously things fail, but when you're forced to do things, you just find solutions, I think. And you find a person to manage your things and to be accountable as much as possible.
Yeah, I think there's like a very deep insecurity that keeps folks from doing that, like not trusting their people and being worried about what happens when I'm gone. You know, I mean, I think that prevents a lot of people from really, you know, hitting that next set of levels because, you know, they have to touch everything.
Man, I just talked about it with someone. I just reread, it's a spiritual book, but I think there's so many lessons there about business as well. The author is Michael Singer. Have you heard of the guy? Name is...
That sounds familiar, yeah.
Yeah, he wrote the Untethered Soul and the Surrender Experience. And now you have a new book. So what I really like about the guy is that it's like this spiritual guru. But then when you really understand and you read about him and his story, the guy built a multi-billion dollar public company, like a software company. And the book is like, he's like going on Oprah as a spiritual guru. So I'm like, okay, that's an interesting story. So what I'm trying to say is that his biggest, basically the lesson of his book is like, you got to let go of your thoughts and almost trust something bigger than you to take over things. And even says that, like I bought a separate Audible from him talking about his work, like how to do his type of work at work. So the main things that he's saying is like, most people always want to be kind of like you said, their ego is like, I need to be in control. I need to lead things. I need to tell people what to do, which is the opposite of what you need to do when you have a team. Like when you have a team, if your team is really good and you trust them, all you really need to do is trust, let go, and listen to them, and then come to a conclusion with them together. Otherwise, why you hire a team? So he's just explaining it in a really nice, non-woo-woo way on why you just need to trust sometimes just something bigger than you and let go of things. Yeah.
That's the key, is getting good advice about this kind of thing without it being woo-woo. I think it's a little hard sometimes.
Yeah. That's why I'm feeling so comfortable talking about him. Like he built a multi-billion dollar public company, software company. And
proof's in the pudding.
Exactly. It's like, okay, cool. I'm happy to be a bit of woo-woo if needed here. No worries. if that's the guy I'm going to learn from.
I wrote that down. Yeah, I'm really interested in taking a look at that one. I feel like I've heard of Michael Singer before, but I never read his stuff, so I'm definitely going to take that one home. Okay, so you're going, you built this team of folks that are doing all these apps. One of them strikes, you know, big winner. So we're right there. Tell me what happens after that.
In between, I also went out there and bought a marketing agency in Canada.
So while the app?
While I'm running the app and have the websites and all that. So I got the marketing agency. I also had the media BuzzFeed-like company back then. All of them, the marketing agency was basically going out there. It's in Calgary. I lived in Calgary for almost a year. But it was a good business. You know, just a very... you know, very stable marketing agency. We bought it at a very fair price, like at a 3x multiples of their profits, which is very fair for a business that's doing more than $1 million a year in revenues. Yeah, we ran it a bit, and then I can talk about what happened with that one as well. But then we also did a similar deal with this BuzzFeed-like company that made some money. And then I used the marketing agency as a leverage to get equity in the media company. That one was doing a few million a year. So I'd say that at the peak, I mean, they were bringing cash flow like crazy. And I was able to get into a photography e-commerce and a Judaica e-commerce, and we also did a bit of a merger between PR and Video Critic. Anyway, I was involved in a few more deals. Then at some point, some of them went down. So the app company eventually went down because Apple pretty much came to me and told me, hey, you can't be here anymore. We're coming up with our version. You want to hear the good story or the stories or the best stories?
Oh, the bad stories.
The best stories? Okay. So, I think my biggest, call it three most painful moments in business were probably all because I was just highly dependent on one source of, call it income from each of those businesses. So the app, like if I can't make money from Apple, I can't really make money, right? It's not like, like I see people right now with e-commerce, like they have their Amazon store, but then they also build in their brand separately. That's great because you diversify yourself. I didn't have that option. So one day they pretty much told you, sorry, you just can't upload another version. So that's pretty much done with the BuzzFeed type company. So that was an interesting story. So that was the one when we did an arbitrage between Facebook ads also and a website with Google AdSense, like super cheesy content, like viral stuff that you still see a lot of people advertise nowadays on the Taboola, if you guys know the Taboola advertising marketplace. We made a lot of money from AdSense. And at one point, they just basically blocked like two of our accounts with hundreds of thousands of dollars in them. And good luck of suing Google. Like, I knew two other people who tried to do that, and they're like, don't even start. Like, unless you're willing to spend millions of dollars on legal fees that might get you some of that money back. Yeah, it doesn't make much sense. So,
man, so you get a punch in the face from Apple and then from Google not too long after that. I mean,
Google twice. And somewhere in there in between, I also got punched very, very hard from Google with their SEO update. What's that name? They had the Panda or Gorilla. I don't know. They had tons of like SEO.
It's always shifting sand.
Exactly. SEO slaps. So you get from a point like it's funny. I remember when I was super young, I remember telling myself, yeah, I'm going to rank some of those websites, have hundreds of those. Each of them are going to make a few bucks a day. And I'm going to have passive income for life. And then you realize that you run a business. The dream, exactly. And I remember I was traveling with a few friends in Europe, and that was when the slaps started to happen. I'm like, oh my God, what's going on here? Like, I thought this is going to be forever. I remember waking up, looking at my stats, and it's like, nope. Yeah, that's I think those were probably my toughest moments when it comes to just getting slaps in the face from reality or from whoever was in that moment.
It's a competitive position, man. I mean, you're playing on their terms, a lot of that stuff. So I've got a question for you. So the marketing agency, right? I'm always curious about folks that figure out good ways systematizing, because it's like a services business, right? But like kind of high touch type of folks. What was your experience trying to maybe systematize and scale it a little bit beyond directly tied to that, you know, incremental hour of labor? You know, did you work a lot on that, or is it really just like, hey, this is a great place for high speed marketing talent, we'll make cash, you know, it's fine?
I tell you what, I think I wasn't as smart back then. The only thing that I saw was just a business that bring in cash flow. And for me to have an opportunity to do a good deal fast, till this day, I don't see myself as the expert when it comes to systemizing things and paying attention to small nuances and details. I think that's probably the most important thing in business. Like, don't get me wrong, I understand. And it's very logic. Like, we had an agency that made money from a specific service or different kind of service. That service, for example, like we had a service that made the most amount of money. So it makes sense to probably put more resources into that service and do more of that. But I think it just was a really good business with recurring revenue. And I don't know, call it, was lucky, had the opportunity. I think my biggest thing is I just have the courage to close deals that most people don't have the courage to do. Like, I see it a lot nowadays. People just afraid to jump into the water and close on a deal. And I don't know if it's perfectionism or they think that they always need a little bit more information on the deal. They always need a bit more data. But at some point, you just gotta make a decision. You're either closed on a deal or you're not. And from what I found out from pretty much every deal that I was involved in, as the entrepreneur myself or as an advisor, you're always going to find new things after you close on a deal that you didn't expect. So I think with that in mind, you just need to ask yourself, like, first of all, are you willing to be okay with the worst case scenario? Do you think that you can at least sustain the same amount of numbers that the business did last year? And do you have a plan for growth? Because if you don't have a plan for growth, I don't think it's worth getting into something in the first place, because then you're just playing the margins game or the, you know, the cash flow to debt ratio game, which is it's dangerous, especially in different economy times. So I don't think that I'm more smart than anyone else. I think I have courage, and maybe that me being in the military or whatnot, I'm just not afraid of what a lot of people might be afraid of. So I'm just doing things, and a lot of them fail. I'm not a special snowflake. I'm just another entrepreneur doing his best and kind of like doing my best, trying to forget the rest. That's kind of my attitude.
That's good. Yeah, I think you, I'm picking up on, I have a pretty fundamental appreciation for risk, I think, you know, it seems. So I'm kind of picking up on all the diversification, and not only within those across your portfolio, but within the businesses, multiple streams, et cetera, single point risk avoidance. So that's fascinating. And what I think part of the reason the rich continue to get ahead is that they're able to throw their risk tolerance around, right? And do those kinds of deals, some of them at least. But I think you can accentuate and make up for it by maybe not actually having the tolerance for risk, but, you know, having the courage to make up for it. That's what you got to do to take it all away, I think.
I have a friend here in Cyprus who took like 9 companies public from the 80s. He took his first company public. And I'm looking at him, I'm like, I'm taking no risk at all, like compared to what this guy did, compared to what this guy tried and failed. So, yeah, I think it's all relative, right, to who you have next to you. Like compared to, everyone is always mentioning Elon Musk, right? Compared to him, we're nothing. I mean, on the entrepreneurial side of things, like the guy got money from PayPal and pretty much invested all of it back into businesses and was about to, like, I think Tesla and SpaceX were about to be bankrupt, like 2 weeks from being bankrupt or something like that. So, you know, and I know enough people that were in similar situations and it didn't work out, right? So
I'm so sorry. Go ahead.
No, you got it. So I'm just saying, it's just an interesting question about life. Like, what eventually makes the person who takes risk, like what I'm trying to say is that I know a lot of people who take risks and they're not able to make it. Elon Musk did make it. I overall made more than I lost, but I don't know. It's just interesting to think out loud about life. Like who's going to make it? Who are really making it when they're taking a risk? What's the reason? So yeah, anyway, sorry. I was interrupting you as well.
And one of the things I think is fascinating about the Elon story is when, you know, he's sitting on the couch after PayPal and does SpaceX. And then I think it was like the first 4 explode, you know, and he's like down to his last dollar. He's like, let's do another one. You know, and everybody around him is like, Elon, I really don't know if this one's gonna work out. He's like, I'll be fine, you know, go ahead, shoot that rocket. I'm like, god damn, man. I mean, taking those companies public, that's pretty fascinating. So it ties into another question here too, which is like, can you kind of pull out or think about some of the folks that were real, you know, mentors for you or had a big impact over a long period of time? You know, any thoughts or comments on kind of the whole mentor thing here?
I think that mentors are super important. I think that at this point I had quality thousands of mentors. From books and people that I met, a lot of books. Like, I think books gave me the most amount of answers that a person would ever give me. I think that the difference is that when you meet a person and he actually went through that, through something similar that you read through in a book, it just gives you more certainty to act and more clarity. And I think that's what we're missing in general. And that's why we're looking for mentors. We're just looking for someone to help us shut our brain from all of the overwhelming thinking that we're doing. And when we have someone who kind of been there, done there, it's just like, yeah, just do this or don't do this. I think it's helpful. But I also had, I want to say that I learned from every mentor that I had, but I also think that some of those mentors also probably slowed my progress, right? So I'm just sharing that because I think a lot of people are just like, yeah, just find a mentor and you'll be good. And they're just forgetting to trust themselves. So I think finding the balance is key. And I think I'm still at a point of like trying to find that balance and trust more my intuition, my kind of thought process. Like I would say that if people listen to it, it's like, remember that even if you're young and you're asking for advice from someone older, yeah, maybe you have more experience, but it doesn't, like, no one knows about your business as much as you. I don't care what they've done. You know, I think that's the biggest thing. Like, no one is in their day-to-day, like, hustling, grinding. So in the end of the day, like, make the decision. Don't make decisions just because a mentor told you.
I think that's right on the head. I just had a wedding a week ago. And one of the things that sometimes we'll do is like write down your advice and like put it in a thing, you know? And I didn't write anything down, but I was thinking to myself like, man, I hope they don't take all this advice. You know what I mean? Like, a lot of it is people who had terrible divorces and, you know, they have no idea what they're talking. They don't even follow it themselves. It's just kind of like willy-nilly. So, and they don't know anything about their day-to-day lives. You know what I mean? I think you're right. There's a balance between, you know, respecting people that have the experience, et cetera, which is very real. There's one more quote that comes to mind from Marcus Aurelius. A man has to stand tall. He can't do it by being held up his whole life, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, you need to be able to have, you know, that personal integrity to yourself to stand up straight.
I think the biggest advice you can give someone like is share with them what you went through. Like I'm thinking from the mentor side of things, share with them what you went through, but then let the person decide on his own. Like to tell someone, yeah, do this, do that. I'm sorry. It sounds like I'm frustrated about mentors because I'm not. I learned so much, but I think like I'm just sharing things that I wish that I knew a few years ago. Just don't have blind faith in people. In the end of the day, none of us know really what we're doing. All of us are just trying to figure it out, you know? We just act like we do.
Well said. Yeah. So let me take you back to the story though. So you got some punches in the face from big tech guys, saw the marketing agency going well. So take me from there to how do you get to acquisitions.com?
Yeah, so I had at some point probably like 16 businesses, including I was a partner in this investment banking /VC firm in Israel that was investing in tech companies. And at some point I was just like, okay, I'm done. I was overwhelmed, tired, and I was just like, I need a break. So I had the opportunity to sell basically all of my equity and all of my holdings to one of my partners. That led me into basically going on a second round of being a global citizen. So I was kind of like living everything back home, traveled wherever I wanted. I guess I became bored. I had the opportunity to get the acquisitions.com thing. I also started doing random YouTube videos because a friend just told me, like I was traveling with a friend. He was like, he was doing a lot of those videos and like, dude, you need to do them as well. You have so much to offer. So I started doing some of them. And then it slowly, led to acquisitions.com, which I've been doing for the last 3 years. I feel like it's the first business that I feel like I actually make an impact with the business. Like we supported 100 plus acquisitions. Some of those people we supported
changed their life.
Never had a business before. Yeah, never had a business before. And right now with kind of like the network that we built, I'm super excited. Like we announced like a month ago that we want to roll up the agency space, the marketing agency space. We already have 150 million in revenues in our pipeline, just early conversations, but still just from few emails to our network, right? So we have a lot of deal flow coming just because we are acquisitions.com and a lot of investors looking to invest in deals. So I'm super excited to see where we can take this. I think that it's it's almost like an ecosystem, a platform to find, for me, to find deals and find money and just do tons of those consolidations.
How did you, when you were first looking at it, was, did you basically just find the domain out there? You know, how did you, what kind of, what was that development at the early stages looking like?
A lot of luck, just luck. Yeah, I'm probably just from my habit of looking at domains, and that's my space, right? Was my space for a lot of time, like many years ago. So I just saw an opportunity. I negotiated on the domain for a few months, and I just had the option to get a good deal there. Now I'm a bit regretting that I didn't buy acquisition.com as well, because I had the option as well, and then Alex Hormozi bought it a few months after that. But it's all good. He's been killing it. So it's funny, he messaged me after he bought it. It's like, hey man, what's up? How much did you buy the So yeah, I got that. I just bought rollups.com as well. I want to see if I can do something interesting with
that. Oh, wow. Nice.
Yeah, I like the domain game. It's like anything else. Just, I don't know. Just probably like what a lot of entrepreneurs are doing. They're just going to random GoDaddy or Namecheap or whatnot. They're typing random names that they have in mind, and they see what's available. Yeah, and a lot of those things are not available. I'm just allowing myself to get into negotiations with some of those domain owners, and some of them will be good deals.
I had I was always kind of playing around with them, and I would make websites when I was like in high school. Eventually, I bought like the domain of the name of my friend, and like put a terrible like YouTube video like redirect on it, and he was just like furious, and it was hilarious, and everybody was going to all the time. And from then on, I was just hooked, you know. So I just started like acquiring all these different ones. But it's fun, man, and like going in and just kind of like playing around, see if you can like scoop up some names. It's always fun.
Man, I love it. In my domain period, like I remember I used to buy some of the websites I had until. What happened, like I'll tell you a story right now. So I used to buy, I used to find restaurants, and like, I remember specifically Applebee's.
That's good. That's a
so
good
I,
one. Yeah.
So I used to buy, I bought like Applebee's coupons, and then I bought some other restaurants with coupons. And I remember I was able to rank them so fast with an amazing affiliate offer. But then I got like, a cease and desist, not letter, freaking book. So I was like, okay, no, that's not gonna work. But just, I don't know, just some funny, interesting stories that you go through. And then
everybody gives me so much crap for sawhook.com, but I finally got it from like some like great aunt that I never met. She was like so, I don't know, she's like a travel agent. And okay. Finally, I never met her. She's like so distantly related. She finally went out of business. I was like, yes, I finally got sawhook.com. I was so happy.
That's awesome. Yeah.
Okay, all right. So you're in, you've got all these businesses that you find, acquisitions.com. How did you go about building that network, right? So like, how do you get it started on both the supply and demand side? How did you go about finding the investors, finding the deal flow? Would you kind of pull them in from third parties? You know, what did that look like?
I wasn't that smart. I wasn't really overthinking it. It just like literally just people. So I just sent an email list. I built an email list. That's all I've done. And in the email list, some people want to buy businesses. Some people want to invest in businesses. They don't want to do the hard work. They just want to be like, hey, you have a deal? Like you have something to invest in? Send it over.
Light it up.
Yeah. And then we were able to syndicate some of those deals or help kind of like with an accelerator for people who want to buy the business. And then we had some people who were just like, hey, can you help me sell my business? So we could probably do a much better job. Like I see right now, there's a website, I think doing great, Acquired. Have you heard about those guys?
Yeah.
Like, I think they're doing a really good job of building a marketplace, and they raise capital from some of the best angel investors. I think that if I wanted to build like a proper marketplace, that would be the model. But I don't know, for some reason, and don't get me wrong, I was actually thinking about doing something similar, but I was like, I started paying a developer. I'm like, do I really want to put a lot of money into developing this? Or
yeah. $500,000 down the drain.
Yeah, exactly. Or do you want to play the VC route, which I don't know if I'm that excited. Like I'm originally from like I'm Israeli, Tel Aviv. The VC world is very like strong there, but I just, it's such a zero, either zero or one game that I don't know if I want to play, but we'll see. I'm still kind of like trying to figure out the best route for acquisitions.com and what we're building, and kind of like the rollups.com. I feel like based on what we have right now, because of the email list that we build, because of all the call it deal flow and investors flow we're getting, and just my passion, I think that it just goes back to building companies and rollups. Like, I was always excited about rollups. I know you guys are also going to support some of those.
Yeah, Falconer, they're huge into that. That was a lot of what Chuck did before he found us. He was a president of a bank, but one of the big niches he was in was doing the financing behind a lot of those rollups. So right now they do that, and a big part of their business is doing the structuring on like the first institutional, like getting an A round together.
Nice.
Those are two like kind of main things that they do, but they do other stuff.
That's exciting. So we supported, for example.
Oh yeah, they're just killing it. It's ridiculous.
That's exciting. Like we supported a roll up in the Amazon FBA space that is doing now around 200 million revenues in less than a year from scratch.
That's fantastic.
Like insane. And pretty much, yeah, that was their route. Like first round from kind of like their network. And then they went out there and started raising institution capital. And I mean, I think that's the...
You ever thought about like syndicating minority position in acquisitions.com based on your list? Because I know StartEngine did a similar thing where they're like, hey, we're just going to sell StartEngine equity like on our platform. They got in a little bit of trouble about it because the founder was like offing some of his own shares. And like, I think the disclosure was a little bit off. But yeah, then it's really just like everybody's still within the ecosystem. You know what I mean?
I think it could be actually an interesting route. Basically saying, hey, invest in acquisitions.com, you're saying, and then use that capital to either invest in others
lifelong
or
partner.
Whatnot. Yeah.
Yeah. Next level, you get first shot at the trough or something like that.
Could be. I saw a girl that doing that with Backstage Capital. I think, have you heard about them? Harlan. I know her. She did that. But I don't know. I don't know if it makes sense unless, like...
Because I mean, they're really looking for like a full ownership. Is that, you know, they're taking over business. But
I think... If you raise capital from investors and you don't really have a path for liquidity, I don't think it's fair. So for acquisitions.com, unless we decide to be the holding company of lots of rollups or whatnot, like there's a company that's doing that in e-commerce, Open.store. Have you heard about those guys?
Yes.
Yeah. So that's super exciting, right? What they're basically becoming a holding company for e-commerce. So unless we become something like that, then I don't know if it makes sense to raise capital from investors, but
kind of your own sleeve that's held within that ecosystem. Yeah. How have you dealt with that so far? I mean, so you're a pretty global citizen. I don't know if it's, you know, directly registered in the US, and you know, you're dealing with different regulatory environments. How have you approached that, you know, without just burning money for lawyers? You know,
first of all, I burned a lot of money with lawyers. But pretty much the same way that a local... So the only difference between me and a local US citizen or resident is that I just have a bit better tax treatment when it comes to me taking the money out for myself. But when it comes to raising capital or, you know, dealing with SEC or... different fund structures or syndications, it's the same process. Like, I still need to go through everything and do it properly if I don't want to go to jail, I think, and I don't want to go to in the next few years.
That's a good goal.
Yeah. So unfortunately, I'll probably continue to pay lawyers a lot of money to make sure I'm not going to jail. But that's pretty much the same process. Yeah, I need to go through the same process.
Dealing with legal is a nightmare. I mean, like... Because it's not something you want to mess around with, but if you have the high-powered attorneys doing everything, then, I mean, you're dead. I mean, it's just not sustainable. So it's like, it's almost like you have to get a workhorse and then have like the high-powered ones kind of overseeing it. But then it creates a whole lot of, you know, then you got like multiple lawyers and, you know, it's interesting.
That's the nature of...
It's a challenging problem.
Yeah, you know, I just had a call with who was the chief legal officer for WeWork. At their peak, And it's a girl who was their chief legal officer. They had more than 200 lawyers internally at their peak.
At WeWork, they had 200 more attorneys?
Globally, right? So they had tons of offices and whatnot. But still, 200. And that's just their internal team. I'm not even talking about all their internal team right. are also using external.
That's before they get into any litigation.
Yeah, yeah. And that's before using. So there's tons of external. So I talked to their external, actually to one of their external legal team that was doing a lot of their M&A stuff. So like every big company, they have their internal legal team and then they have external legal team that they work with. I mean, that's the nature of the biz, but that's what you do when you raise unlimited amount of capital. You can do whatever you want. And it's an interesting game that I'm thinking a lot about lately. It's something that I've never done at scale, like raising capital at scale. But when you, and that's, if you ask me probably what's something that I probably need to do and I didn't do yet, it's something like that. Because that's where you play with the big guys. Like you see the biggest companies in the world that we all look up to that are all on NASDAQ or whatnot. Like most of them raise tons of capital. Now it's dilute the founder a lot. Like if you look at Elon Musk, Bezos, all the big guys, they own less than 20% of their companies, right? Zuckerberg. But at the same time, a lot of them still maintain control with different class shares. So it's just a game that you need to ask yourself if you're willing to pay. So that's one way of looking at things. Then I just heard about a guy here locally in Cyprus who took $780 million dividend last year with a private company in the financial.
Okay.
It's kind of like in a bit of a gray sector. It's kind of like in the Forex space, but still that's another way of looking at it, right? Like a super cash flowing business. I'm not saying that that's a sector I would ever want to get into because it's super shady, but there are tons of private businesses out there that are making tons of money that most people don't know about the owner, nothing. So it's a question that I'm asking myself a lot lately. Like, do I care about like building a brand that everyone will know about or, you know, kind of like building that fame? Or do I just want to build a great company that will create great impact and make a lot of money. Like the Coach, what's their name in the US? Coach family. Have you heard about those? That family? Coach, K-O-C-H. Yeah, so they're probably one of the wealthiest family in the world out there and most people don't know about them.
Yeah, we had a we had someone come to us from their family office. And so I got a little bit educated on that family and I was blown away. You know, you'd think that some of those families are just like, you know, riding on the name. And to some extent, that's true. But a lot of them, they've got a lot of other stuff going on. I think your approach to it is right, you know, as a platform ecosystem. So throughout this whole time that you've, you know, been building up to this, gaining all the entrepreneurial experience, et cetera, we talked about a few of those hard lessons learned. But do you have any more that come to mind for the folks listening?
Probably my biggest lesson is just the people you have around you. That's the most important thing when it comes to growing a business. And whenever the more I grow, the more I realize that what I thought is a quality team member, partner, employee, investor, like my standards just increase. And I just didn't know what is a quality employee or team member back then. And now I understand that if you have even an average idea, like a super, the idea doesn't matter, but if you bring people who just been there, done that, know what they do, you can build anything you want. And I just didn't appreciate it as much in the past because I thought that, and probably another thing that I learned or read about somewhere or someone told me, yeah, just only care about the character of the person and everything else they can learn. Now, don't get me wrong. Obviously, there's truth to that. But what do you think? You're going to grow faster if you had... So assuming you need like a head of sales, head of marketing, head of product, engineering, client, obviously it depends on the business and whatnot. But let's say you have a head of each department. Do you think you're going to do better with someone who have a great character, is going to learn a lot and going to try to figure it out on his own? Or are you going to do better just finding someone who did the same, pay them more money and just let them lead that department? I think that if I had to pick one lesson, that would be the lesson. Just find those people that did it already, find a way to pay them. And a lot of time, it's very difficult to pay them if you have a small business. And that's why, again, back to the raising capital question, there's a lot of value to that. And you understand that the people in Silicon Valley, there's a reason for them doing that, because there's a lot of value of having that war chest right away and being able to attract talent from the get-go. It's just something that you just can't ignore. And something I wish I knew, yeah.
That was a very similar lesson that I learned from one of my first early forays was running a maid company, right? Songbird Maids. Well, that was kind of a side hustle. I was working at, you know, a very square job. And it was interesting. We got like, you know, a dozen maids, and, you know, it was all kind of, it was tuned up pretty well. It was working. But the quality of folks that you're working with is vastly important on the quality of your life. And so being able to surround yourself with like wonderful people that are highly skilled, deeply motivated, and, you know, see a larger purpose in their role, it's just night and day on your life, I mean, for sure. So I can certainly appreciate what you're saying.
Yeah, what you just mentioned is super important that I didn't say there, but 100%, just for the quality of your life. Like, if you don't want to hate, if you don't want to hate your life, yeah, the quality of the people around you is so important. 100%.
Yeah, sustainability. Okay, all right. Well, we're about at the hour here, Ron. Any other parting wisdom for the folks?
Oh man, I really really enjoyed it. Like this conversation, like, super chill, awesome, open conversation. I love that, man. So anytime you want to do this conversation again, let me know.
Moran of acquisitions.com, thanks for stopping by, buddy.
Hey, you listen, it's going down just like this.
This has been an Audley production. Thank you for tuning in.
Yeah. Yeah.
Our producer is Matt Wells. Oh. Our audio engineer, David Woji. Uh-huh. I'm your host, Sam Sawhook.
Yeah.
Please like and subscribe. That helps get the word out. Have a lovely, lovely day. We'll see you next time.